Well, good evening and welcome to the Philip Larkin Centre's event. I'm delighted to be welcoming Jill Dawson to meet us tonight. We last met on the lawns at Grantchester in the summer of some year past. I don't know quite when it was. And I read this book myself in a sort of in a little house in France last winter when I arrived in France and the whole place was completely like a medieval village because snow had come and electricity had gone. And it was the most sort of freezing period of my life, but I sat down and read The Great Lover and was transported to sort of wonderful summer locations in China and then finally in Tahiti. So it is a glorious read. And it's also sort of marking sort of Armistice Day for us because the central character in it is Rupert Brooke, who sort of died in those early years of the war. And Jill has had sort of quite a varied career. You know, she started off by sort of gaining some public attention by winning a National Short Story Award. That was at the age of 22. Since then, there have been 6 novels published, really sort of using this idea of biographical research and then reinventing the lives through novels. Mm-hmm. 6 collected sort of works of other people as well, and anthologies that she's produced. She's also won an Eric Gregory Award for poetry and also awards for her scripts. So there's a whole varied amount of work that she's covered. She's very articulate as well. When we were meeting at Grantchester, it was sort of myself interviewing Jill for a book that I wrote about mentoring for creative writing. And so many parts of that book that peppered through it were Jill's wisdom, Jill's advice and experience. She's very engaged in that sort of front line of teaching and working with writers. In fact, she actually also runs a mentoring service now called Gold Dust. And I think there are some leaflets about that here at the front. So I really recommend sort of Jill as a teacher as well. And she's taught on MA courses as well at UEA. And so quite a sort of a regular and committed sort of life in writing. She's been on the tour quite a bit this year, I think. This book is really connected. It was a Richard and Judy summer pick. And as I told you, it's a great summer read. And the Rupert Brooke connection has really worked, hasn't it, Jill? Mm. And I just wondered what the pull of Rupert Brooke is. Is it the poetry? Is it the sort of the emblematic guy? Is it the Cambridge connections? Is it the loss of somebody like sort of Jim Morrison or something, somebody sort of dying early? What's the appeal for you of Rupert Brooke?
Yeah, a little of all of that, I think. I think you were quite modest in your introduction in not mentioning that actually Martin had a much more instrumental role in this novel, and I'll tell you it from as okay. I remember it, which was we met at the Orchard. We hadn't met before. I don't know who suggested that venue, you or me, but I have always loved the Orchard, the place, and it's connected with Rupert Brooke. There's lots of leaflets there about Rupert Brooke. But novels often start with a place for me. So I remember, this is how I remember it, that we were sitting having our cup of tea, and I said, I'd love to set a novel here about all these people, Rupert Brooke, Virginia Woolf, E.M. Forster, all the people who passed through. And Martin said, why not? And I kept saying, I don't think I'll be able to do it. Oh, no, I can't do it. And he just kept saying, why not? And as writers among you will know, that idea of being given permission, of someone actually saying, well, what's the problem, is often all we're asking for. So for me, it was that I hadn't necessarily known the poetry very well. I knew the standard ones that everyone knows, The Soldier, The Old Vicarage, Grantchester. I did know him as a sort of the poster boy for sort of foppish good looks, and there's some sort of shame around him as a First World War poet, isn't there, in the sense that he didn't see active service. So I think unlike Owen or Sassoon or anyone who actually lived long enough to turn against the war, there is something about Rupert Brooke where he was the patriot and he gets rather despised for that. So I knew those bare minimum things about him, and it was all of those things, and it was you giving me permission.
I'm curious as well, but there you are, sort of already sort of 5 novels down. And you've been shortlisted for the Whitbread Prize, you've been shortlisted for the Orange Prize, and yet you're really nervous about embarking on another project. How vulnerable we writers are in.
But it doesn't get any easier, no. I don't think. I mean, would you say that?
Yeah, you're taking on new challenges and new voices and new characters all the time.
And it also feels like that. I imagine this might be what it's like to be a performer, although since I'm not musical, I don't know. But the idea that you never know if this occasion might be the one where you just fall on your face. Mm. There is a sense to me, I'm starting something new at the moment, mm. and I'm having exactly that feeling of, oh my God, you know, I've got away with something this mm. far. I've managed to write novels and people haven't noticed that, you know, yeah. I'm rubbish or something. So there's always the feeling it might be waiting around the corner.
And I suppose you also had, I mean, the Rupert Brooke Society, which was based there, we mm. went and looked around the museum together. You bought the postcard, which helped spur things. But people are invested in the life of Rupert Brooke,
yes.
and there's you trampling across their sacred territory. That's a bit scary, isn't it?
Utterly. And as you all know, in that area, I mean, there's a Rupert Brooke pub that you're going to eat a Rupert Brooke burger, which mm. I did recently with my husband. Just I don't know why. It was a bizarre experience. There's the old vicarage next door where Geoffrey and Mary Archer live. Mm. I mean, it's Rupert Brooke, if you haven't been there. So there's absolutely a feeling that this is territory, that people own him in some way and are very possessive about him. And I think those were the fears I had, that I would offend people or that somehow it wasn't mine and couldn't be made mine. And also things, I mean, I do remember you saying, me especially saying, I didn't even go to Cambridge, I won't be able to get that aspect of it right. I mean, it's things to do with me feeling wrong in every way. But I do wonder if I don't always have that at the beginning of a novel. I find a form to latch it onto. Mm. So on this occasion, it was the Rupert Brooke Society will attack me. But I think with Watch Me Disappear, you know, I worried that I'd offend people because it's partly set in Soham and mentions the Soham mm. girls. And with the previous book,
Did it offend people?
No. The things I dread don't ever seem to come to pass, but that one's just been bought by ITV.
Oh, right.
And who knows what they'll do with it. There's still room to offend people, I fear. So.
You don't have to worry about that part, though.
Well, I sort of think I don't need to take responsibility yeah. for it, because in my version of it, it's very carefully done, let's say. There are three mentions, and they're just mentions from newspapers. They're not, you know, anything that I think would be offensive.
And then you've created your own version of Rupert Brooke, but also you've staffed the tea rooms there. You can still go and have tea in these tea rooms. It's a splendid
yeah.
place. But you've staffed them with the servant girls, with the woman who's running the tea room, and this terrific character of Nell. And Nell's voice is very strong in the book. And I'd like you actually just to sort of give us a little sampling of Nell's voice. We're going to hear two little readings tonight. And some questions and answers from me, but also at the end, some questions and answers from you, I hope. So get those sort of geared up whilst we're listening.
I like the questions and answers. I said that to Martin beforehand. That's a bit I like, so I do hope you've got some for me. Right, this is a bit, it's Nell speaking, and she's talking about Rupert, obviously, who's come to be a tenant at the Orchard, where she's the maid who, you know, cleans out the rooms and runs around waiting on people. And then just when I think I've grown used to his habits, something happens that's so unexpected, so unlooked for, that I no longer know if I'm coming or going, or which way is up. It was only yesterday that I said to Kitty, I know him better than a mother. Bathing every evening, breakfast on the lawn or in his bedroom, young men and women always calling up to the window or throwing a pebble to wake him, and a pencil and a book always in his hand. And somehow, it appears, he manages to be a scholar, too. He mostly takes breakfast in his room. As he has sworn off meat, he breakfasts on coddled eggs, hot milk, some chopped apple or pear, and a cup of tea with honey. His room, when I enter it at 7 o'clock, has that smell I know so well from my old days with my brothers and father, the warm, salty smell of a man sleeping. It must be the loss of father that makes the smell bring such a lurch to my heart. I'm careful always to be brisk in my tone and not to sound sleepy myself or anything that isn't fitting. Wide awake and alert, that's me. I open the curtains, my back to the bed, give him time to bestir himself. I've learned a trick now of opening the window, a brutal push upwards. This admits noises from outside, birdsong, horses clopping past, sometimes a visitor calling up to him, and the ring of a bicycle bell. When Mr. Brooks stirs, there are always more books, letters, and papers next to his pillow which tumble to the floor. Many's the time I've discovered inky stained pillows. I was wrong to abandon the pillow shams. They make a good disguise for the limits of the laundry soap. Then he will prop himself up on one elbow and begin sipping at the milk, not coffee any longer. He's decided to swear off that too and say daft things like, women are bloody, Nell. I pray you remain a child and never become one.
Thank you. And I chose that little piece, and thank you for reading it, because you know, for me it evidences sort of yours and sort of Nell's sense of sounds and smells. You know, you really sort of, it's a very sensual writing, it's a sensual voice that you've got there. Is that an aspect of a writing that you really enjoy yourself, alert to?
Yes, I think all our writing choices probably come from our reading ones, don't they? And I realise that that's what I love to read. And when I was starting out as a writer, it was the early 80s, and I was reading lots of books published by the Women's Press, lots of African-American writers like early Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, Toni Carter Bambara, early Barbara Kingsolver, and this is what they were doing. It was incredibly sensual, it felt to me. And also, I suppose, because I was a poet at that point, for about 10 years, I wrote poetry. But the other thing I've learned through my teaching is I think I've got quite a good sense of smell, and I'm always boasting that in another life I could be a perfumier. So actually, I notice smell a lot,
right.
And I think we all notice different, use our senses differently. I'm quite also, I think, quite tactile. Oh. And some people, I think, have got the great ear and should put that in their writing. So it seems to me that it's a shame to leave the body out of our writing, since it's how we experience the world, and also reading, it seems to me, is a very physical thing, and you experience it through your body with all your feelings and heart racing or, you know, bursting into tears or feeling aroused or feeling angry or upset. That's what happens to me if I'm reading something I'm engaged with. So in a way, I want to engage a reader's body in the work,
that's
actually.
So we're engaging the body, we're including all of that. But I'm also interested in writing about what gets left out to shape a narrative.
Mm.
In this one, we have the sort of, we have the obituary to by Churchill, Rupert Brooke included near the beginning. And Rupert Brooke actually goes to Germany sort of for a while and lives there. And he also encounters some soldiers that and he wonders what the effects would be of their reading his poetry. But war isn't really there as a sort of a present theme. And it sort of stops before the war. And I wondered why you made that choice to actually leave the theme of war out of the book.
I didn't necessarily begin with that idea. I didn't intend to. I had been thinking that I would go up to, I mean, he spent 8 months of the war. It was announced on his birthday in August, and then he died on St. George's Day, April the 23rd. 1915. So he saw some. He went to Gallipoli. I mean, people think he saw no action at all, but it's just he didn't see trench warfare. So I had thought I would cover that, and then I think, in the end, I felt I couldn't do justice. That to me was a whole other 5 years of research to get that right, even if it had been a small section. I just felt that to do that glibly, to tack something on at the end, a little bit of Gallipoli and some people dying or something, would have been trite. And so I made the decision that because I loved, when I was doing an MA in writing, I read Pat Barker's trilogy that won the book of that year, Redemption and, you know, I can't remember what they're all called now.
Eye and the Door.
Yes. What was the other one?
Eye and the Door. And
yes, and one and a third one.
Join in.
And in a funny way, I felt as if she had dealt so brilliantly with that subject, I didn't really want to go there at all. But I also felt that the other thing was that, as I said earlier, Rupert Brooke himself didn't have much of an experience of war, and he would have remained very much in this patriotic, it's all going to be over by Christmas, how marvellous sort of mood, because a lot of people were in that mood in the early stages. And I felt that would have struck the wrong note somehow.
I think there is a before and after, isn't there, with 1914? And you're capturing that precious time that was sort of ripped away.
Yes. Another thing I do feel strongly about, though, is I actually resent, whenever I hear the phrase, I cringe, this idea of the sort of golden summer, of giddy young things sleepwalking towards war, that sort of idea. Because, in fact, all my research showed that it was an incredibly sort of tumultuous time with, you know, Home Rule for Ireland, the suffragettes.
Which features quite strongly.
Yes, behaving in ways you've never known women to behave before or since. I mean, imagine if we were living in times where women were constantly marching and chaining themselves to railings and throwing stones at MPs. I think it was quite actually dramatic times for some sectors of society. There was perhaps a very small privileged group who were doing the giddy young things. And I feel as if it's their version of that period, which is always being talked about. And because I'm including working class experiences, women's experiences, you know, I wanted to give a different version.
Because I wondered if there's an element of yours of willfully trying to put into your novel what sometimes gets left out of history and regular biography. Because we have Nell with her experiences of the Fens and growing up with a family. We have Kitty, the other maidservant, who's off, who is a suffragist. We have swimming is quite a theme, but swimming seems to be an area where the classes all mix, and the clothes are thrown off, and classes including sort of Rupert and Nell very much mix in the water there.
Yes. Well, they swim in different rivers, though, because, of course, Rupert Brooke swam in Byron's Pool and the River Granter, and Nell, who is based in Prickwillow, which is sort of about 20 miles away, or actually less than that, more like 15, swims in the River Lark, which is much better named, I've always felt, for larking about it. And I've swum in both rivers, but I had a very vivid sense of how the River Lark in those days would have been a working river, with people still catching eels, catching fish. It wouldn't be full of Cambridge students having fun. And I wanted to show that contrast just up the road, these two worlds are coexisting. Because again, when I did my research, I kept being struck by this feeling that the Fens was sort of 100 years behind. That when you were talking about people still drinking poppy head tea, which is a sort of laudanum tea, or doping their children with it, you know, at the same time as young women are going to the Slade and Rupert Brooke's Circle are living very modern lives in many ways, I felt as if these two versions needed to be shown to be coexisting. Mm. And you're right, water is somewhere where that could happen.
Mm. And you talk about sort of research, but you also now live in the Fens. Mm. What it was like sort of living in this landscape and evoking a landscape that you'd come to know intimately and was part of your every writing day, I presume.
Yes, I think that helps enormously, doesn't it, to sort of know a landscape well. There's one thing, I did go to Tahiti as well. It's a hard life, you know, the research you have to do. But actually, you know, the glimpse that you can have in a short trip is nothing like seeing a landscape change. Yeah. I mean, there was one day when I was driving and I did see a falconer with a great big bird sort of landing, you know, just out in the field, and that goes straight into the novel because that still goes on in the Fens. We still have an eel catcher near me. You do endlessly, the last remaining one. He does it the traditional way with an eel hive that's shaped like that. And we have, you know, every day on the way to my son's school, there's a heron, a kestrel. I like to put them in because I like the feeling of continuity, that this is how people would have seen it then. These are the things that haven't changed. And similarly in Grantchester, which is very lovely, the meadows still have that feeling, don't they? The orchard itself does. There's plenty, it seems to me, if we're looking back through time, plenty of ways to still find our way into it and not see it as something that was the past and this is now. Plenty of things would be the same, it seems to me.
What happened with the Tahiti episode is you actually bothered to go out there, you say.
Yes.
And I found myself, when I'm doing biographical research, I went sort of around sort of Colorado on a mountaintop trying to see what it was like in 1911. Mm. So you actually get excited by sort of trimming away the things that are now and coming back. But what did you discover in Tahiti that was of the period?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, isn't it Richard Holmes who has that book about biographers going in someone's footsteps?
Yeah, footsteps.
I do love that idea of physically tracing a path. So we went to the places Brooke had been, the main two towns and the route into the sort of greener area in the center. And actually, when we got away from the tourist bit on the beaches, the center did feel incredibly as it would have been, all the ferns, all the foliage, the plants, the fish, give or take a bit of sort of species decline. I imagine it would have been very similar. Again, swimming would be similar. But the thing I was looking for, I mean, I don't want to give away too much about this novel, but I did feel very strongly that one particular biographer who'd suggested Brooke had a daughter out in Tahiti was right. And I went in pursuit of that. And I did find a little bit. I didn't find anything, in a way, to be a biographer, I think you'd have needed more documentary evidence. Mm-hmm. I had verbal sort of affirmation, people sort of seemed to believe he had a daughter. And when I came back to England, actually, and I did Women's Hour, someone rang the program and said he had met Rupert Brooke's daughter in the 1970s, when she was still alive. She died about 95. Yeah. So I really do think he did, and I'd kind of gone with the logic of imagination, but it was nice to feel, that was true.
So I wonder if you're ever going to meet sort of Nell's descendants. That's going to be interesting. I love Nell. She's terrific. And one of the things that I've, one of the tricks, I think, of turning fact into fiction is to change some element of the fact, and that lets the fiction flow through. And here, you've actually invented this sort of wonderful creation, Nell, and inserted her into Rupert Brooke's life, which has allowed all of this sort of fiction to flow through. I wondered at this point if you could read us that sort of slightly longer section of Nell and Rupert in
Could you all hear me before? Was that fine? I don't need to stand up then, do I? No? Good. Righto. So this is one. Nell is a beekeeper's daughter. She's a very skilled beekeeper. I have a friend in Prickwillow who's a beekeeper, so I went to spend time with him, and he does it the traditional way, and he spins the honey in the traditional way, so that was kind of lovely. So here she is in the old vicarage garden with Rupert, showing him the bees, and she doesn't wear a veil or gloves because she's never been stung. And she has insisted that Rupert wears them, and they belong to her father. Rupert stands, arms folded and watching, while I load the wheelbarrow with the wooden frames, bulging with the weight of honey. But still, he will not drop his look, his eyes so bold, lying softly on my skin, on my bare arms and hands, like something with a tickling, stealthy creep. Perhaps it's this. Perhaps it's that when I work with Mr. Neve, he's full of commands and has never allowed this drowsy, bee-humming silence to take hold of us like this. Whatever it is, my eyes are suddenly glazed with tears, and the ghost of father appears in front of me, while I step quietly to one side to watch. A young man in father's clothes, wearing father's borrowed veil and gloves, is standing in an old, rambling garden and staring hotly at me. Father steps to one side and disappears. Bees purr between us. The young man steps forward and lifts his white veil, moving his face towards mine. He pulls me towards him. The movement is forceful, not gentle. He angles his head like a bird. Using his hand, he tilts my chin up to his mouth and moves towards me. The bees sizzle round us like a pan of fat on the stove. I close my eyes at once. I feel the hardness of Rupert's teeth with my tongue. I open my mouth a little, not knowing what else to do. Flakes of sunlight flutter like confetti on my eyelids. And that's it. He kisses me in the old vicarage garden, and I disappear for a moment. Then I return, alert to the danger all around me. The bees, a bee heading straight for Rupert. Bees are quick to smell opportunity. You should never lift your veil, I say nervously. Be still now. No, don't move. Don't run. They'll chase you in a beeline, straight as an arrow. Now he's mine to rescue. I tell him to stay calm. He wants to put the veil back, but it's too late, much too late, I think. One bee is on his chin, edging up towards his mouth. The terror in his eyes is quite real. I see by the wildness in his look that he wants to flap and scream and run about, but he puts his trust in me, like a small boy, like one of my brothers. And it's this, finally, that's my undoing. I could have held off, I reckon, if it weren't for this. His teasing, his naughtiness, his insults, his demands, his flirting, even the sight of him naked as the day he was born. I could resist them all. But not that one small thing, a glimpse of the boy. I say, Rupert shouts, slaps at his mouth. The bee strikes. With this one gesture, thousands of bees await instruction, trembling round us like an electric storm. I talk softly to them. The bees are hot and not persuaded. Haven't I been a good girl? Haven't I treated them well? What's one little accident between friends? I listen intently and sniff at the air, which smells of smoke, and I hear Rupert holding his breath. Then the note in the air drops just one notch, and that's our sign. Quickly, I fasten Rupert's veil at his neck, and he, gasping and laughing quietly, allows himself to be led back to the house. My word, he crows the moment we're in the safety of the scullery at the orchard with his veil off. My word, what a thing. Who'd have thought it? The bees do your bidding. I pick the sting. sting out of the spot at the corner of his mouth with my nails, dab honey on the sore place, and bid him under my breath to be quiet. He should thank his lucky stars that it was just the one bee, I say, that took it into its head to misbehave. His lip is a little swollen, but that's to be expected. That tickles him. Just the one, yes indeed. Thank the Lord, eh, Nell, that it was just the one outrageously naughty bee that transgressed. I don't know what he finds so funny. My fondness for him of a minute ago melts. Why does he never take things seriously? Well, I'm not one of his Cambridge girls who only knows her books and bicycles. He needn't think he can take liberties with me. The bees showed him that. Nell Golightly might be just a maid from Prick Willow, but she can face facts, and she won't be anybody's fool. I thought that would put an end to it, cap it tight, the feelings. I really did. But that night, just as I'm undressing for bed, Kitty already snoring at her place by the wall, the oddest memory strikes me, and my heart cracks open again like a walnut shell. It's Father at the front step in the morning, polishing my shoes before school. He has one hand inside the little boot, and the ground is all frost and ice, and he's rubbing with the cloth and a tiny speck of polish, shining the leather until he can see his face, his old, tired face reflected in it. He did this every morning. He never wanted me to go to school. He didn't think I'd amount to anything. But this was his one austere service year on year, offered to me wordlessly and accepted without thanks. I remember it now as the yeasty heat of Kitty in the bed rises up to me. I remember Father's tongue peeping at the corner of his mouth, the flecks of black polish on his hand, his concentration. Father, where are you? I want to ask. I picture him from the dream I had of him the night he died, the dream of him leaving me, getting up from his chair, looking straight at me. Father, I want to tell you something. I remember what you did, and I want to say thank you. Maybe it wasn't much by some people's standards, but I want to tell you something I never thought I would. It was enough. I know how to do it, how to love.
Thank you. And that last part with the father, this is the same father that always wanted a boy, and very difficult relationships between him and Nell, but she's found that moment of love. And then in that relationship with Rupert Brooke, I realized that there was as much repulsion as attraction, and there's a lot of drama that came from the friction. And just something I note, really.
Yes. Well, I felt that this question of the great lover, the title, which is obviously a poem of Rupert Brooke's, and was intended ironically by him as much as me. And when this book came out just before Valentine's Day, I did worry that people might buy it as a gift and not realise he's a rubbish lover, you know. But the person I thought who could love and did love was Nell. And from the start, Nell knew how to love, I felt. I didn't deliberately give her a reason for that, but that's the understanding I came to, is that she had had enough love to know how to do it. Brooke has a much more troubled relationship with love. He has many love affairs. He can't seem to make up his mind. He pushes people away as well as pulling them forward. And I felt as if the great lover, if it was anyone, is Nell, in fact. And of course, she would find him difficult, and there would be that push-pull thing, because he is very uncertain of himself. And I don't think I made that up either. I think that was very present in his letters and in his writings, this complete conflict about sexuality, about need and dependence on other people, difficult relationships with his mother, his father, the death of his older brother. So I felt that I wasn't making that up especially, but I was kind of pushing it, I suppose.
And you fed Nell with lines from a lot of the other women in Rupert Brooke's life. And there was a part that I think, that was interesting, but it was actually, who was it? It was Gwen Raverett's experience of leaving the body.
Yeah.
Just suddenly leaving the body and viewing your own life from the stairs.
Yes.
And so she's a fusion of lots of other women in Rupert Brooke's life. And you've even given sort of crucial pieces of dialogue to her that were lifted from other people's writings. Yet, I also sort of suspected there was a great amount of the author, of you, in Nell. Even latterly, she becomes a writer of stories for women's magazines. You know, she becomes a writer. And I wondered, you know, to what degree do you identify with Nell?
Well, it's a funny question, because I think Nell's the obvious one to identify with me. But in many ways, I can disguise myself more easily through Rupert Brooke, because I don't get asked that question. So because I've been doing a lot of readings from this book, in the beginning, especially ones back home in Cambridge, I would be more cautious about what I said. But actually, in time, I've said more openly that the bit when Rupert Brooke has a breakdown, when his poetry first comes out, is very much my own story. I think I wrote poetry young. I wasn't very good, I don't think, despite winning a Gregory. I've always been embarrassed about my poetry. Began to understand that the business being published was going to be painful for me, and embarrassing and difficult. And I think I felt a great freedom in saying that through Rupert Brooke, because he also seemed to find some of those feelings. Nell is easier. Nell is a sort of amalgam of various women in my family. I think she physically probably looks like my mum, who is a, you know, can you think of a sort of young Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet, with lovely violet eyes and dark hair and very curvaceous? That's how I've always pictured Nell. So very strong physical presence to me, and she's got traits of my big sister, who's very, it's like a domestic goddess, you know, really brilliant in the kitchen and things, which I'm not. So for me, Nell's got all the things I love about women who are close to me. She's probably got some traits of mine, but one of my friends who read this novel really laughed at the bit where Nell said that she was perfectly sensible and she wasn't going to fall for Rupert Brooke, and she thought she'd just stay at the orchard to keep an eye on the other girls. and my friend Catherine was really convinced that sort of self-delusional aspect that Nell was sensible rather than romantic was coming from me.
Right.
So I'm sure that might be true. But also, I suppose I'm drawing on things. I did have a grandmother who was a maid in service in a big house. I don't know much about her. My mum had a friend called Izzy Golightly, and Nell is a Nell Golightly. So, you know.
There's also a Pudsey Dawson, a dog.
Yes.
A namesake. Is it related?
But it's true. The funny thing about Pudsey Dawson is that was a real dog.
Right.
And Brooke mentions it about three times in letters.
Six.
Well, because I like the name. Exactly, yeah.
That's good. And then, if I'm... I sort of write biography as well as novels, and in choosing a biographical subject, I try and choose somebody that it'll be nice to live with for years and that I can actually learn from. And I wonder what the experience was like for you, because you set a puzzle at the very beginning of the book. You asked the question, is Rupert Brooke a good man? Which means that, having said it early on, I felt the book was set to explore that. And I wondered where you came out in the end with Rupert Brooke, and where you... I mean, have you parted with him yet? Are you still exploring? And how has it changed?
Well, when I, a friend who's a biographer, another biographer friend, asked me whether I'd ever dreamed about him. And I really wanted to and didn't dream about him during the writing of it. But since the book came out, I have had a few odd dreams and thought, oh, if only I could have had those before. Because there's something when a character enters, I don't know if you find this, but if they're actually in your dreams, you think, right, they're really under my skin now. There's a sort of channeling. I think I had the experience towards Rupert Brooke that Nell has, really. I think my journey was similar to hers in that way of finding him infuriating. I thought about, I'm sure I would have fallen for him. He was very handsome, he was very clever, he was very sexy, he was very witty. He was one of those, I mean, so many people know the experience of falling for an absolutely infuriating, brilliant man or woman, but I think maybe it is more of a female experience. And then hanging on in there, thinking he will change and somehow, you know, recognize your brilliance one day and how much he needs you. So I feel there was some of that going on. Yeah. And in the beginning, in a way, I imagined myself writing a colder portrait of him. And then as I got to know him and as his voice started to come through and I wrote pieces in his voice, I felt very differently about him.
It's quite bold writing pieces in Rupert Brooke's voice.
Well, that was probably the thing that terrified me the most, yes, and actually did not intend to do. But the problem, again, was the sort of immersion. It's a bit like method acting or something, immersing myself in his writing. I kept just being able to hear his syntax and his phrasing, and it seemed so easy in the end to mimic it. And I have been quite pleased when reviewers have got it wrong and said, oh, this is a brilliant piece of writing by Jill Dawson, something, this bit, and it's like, oh, that bit's Rupert Brooke.
Yeah,
or the other way around. I definitely feel the blending did fool people, which I've enjoyed.
I didn't know until the end that you were quoting Rupert Brooke's letters.
Yes.
And I thought it was quite remarkable that you managed to find a rather stilted version of Rupert Brooke for the letters.
Yes.
He came alive again outside of it. But.
Because that's the thing, is that, funny enough, I think that he had many styles in his letter writing. When you read a collected letters and it's two different recipients, you see how someone changes their letter to their mother, the letter to their secret lover, the letter to a girlfriend that is platonic, those kinds of things. I think he was very masterful at the changing the register and the voice. So that was a difficulty too, of how to mimic his various voices.
And dividing yourself as well, because you've got this sort of this luscious Nell, and then this reasonably effete, intellectually spry Rupert Brooke. And people say it's quite difficult to cross gender.
Yes.
For a woman to write a man, but you not only write about a man, you actually also enter his sort of quite vivid homosexual experiences. What's that like?
I have done it before. In Wild Boy, there's a long section from the male doctor's point of view, and actually, I think it feels to me an easy thing to do if you have guidance, because I also had that voice. That was a true person, and I felt I was, in some ways, it was a kind of ventriloquism. I think if I completely conjured Rupert Brooke up, that would have been harder. Mm. And I was careful to use language I thought he would use, although it's a novel, and I've always said it's a novel, I don't feel comfortable with what I think of as cheating. Mm.
You wouldn't take a fact and distort it?
No, I don't. I mean, I have done many, many talks with other writers who would, and I sort of have no problem with them doing it, but there's something going on for me which is to do with investigating something to find out a truth, not trying to change it to suit my purpose. I genuinely actually feel more interested if I try to sort of, for example, if I think of the experience of Rupert's father dying, I read everything I could find, every poem that might relate to that, every letter, to see how did he seem to feel about that. And then I think it had it had layers of feeling, because he felt one thing and expressed another sometimes. And I wouldn't have felt able to take that subject without having really immersed myself and read properly all the things I could find on it. And the same with the experience with Denham Russell Smith, the young man he sort of seduces, really, at the orchard, is he doesn't refer to that very often. In fact, he downplays it thereafter and calls it a pretty affectation. I'm not so sure that's really how he felt, but I sort of stayed true to his being glib about it, let's say, because there wasn't much evidence of anything else.
And when you're researching, do you actually get excited by the holes in the story that you discover, because you can inhabit them with the novelist? Is that part of the trick?
Yes, I mean, I think a bit like a biographer. I don't know, since I've never written one, but I think also things that feel, it's very thrilling to come across something you don't think other people have found, and there was a set of letters that are new and haven't been included, newly found, from this Phyllis Gardner, a young student at the Slade. And I got very excited by her memoir, which was incredibly sexy and sort of vivid. I thought, oh, perfect, now I've got a really strong version of him. And I think that will come out in someone else's book eventually. So I knew someone was working on that, and I didn't want to step on her toes. But on the other hand, it was such a find.
Yeah.
So it's that feeling. There's sort of, I like the research that feels new and fresh, but as nothing is, of course, but there's the illusion that it is, I suppose. As for the gaps, no, I'm more troubled by those. It is more of the feeling of I don't want to totally deceive. So, for example, I only put in people I knew he had been lovers with, whereas there is some speculation over others, and if there wasn't evidence, I didn't put them in.
Right.
I mean, people feel, for example, he had perhaps more male lovers, but he wouldn't have been open about that. There's a suggestion he had an affair with Violet Asquith, who's Asquith's daughter, the Prime Minister's daughter, but I couldn't find evidence, so I didn't go with that. I made those kinds of decisions as well, really.
And Rupert Brooke, in life and in your novel, decides to to go off in search of himself, and he realizes he has to leave not only Britain but Europe, very much Britain, and goes off to Tahiti, and I think that's something that happens very much with British writers. They actually have to leave the country in order to discover themselves and discover their voice, I know you were born in Durham, you grew up in Yorkshire, you're now living in Cambridge. But I just wondered, your quality of Englishness, is that from being here, has it been fed by your own trips overseas?
That's a good question, because I always feel I'm slightly out of sync. I didn't do an English degree, for example. I did American Studies, and I went to college in the States. And a lot of my writing has been interested in the vernacular, which it feels to me is a much more American theme than an English one, and has been interested in landscape and individual versus their landscape, really. That was my first couple of novels, I think, which seems a particularly American theme. Mm. And as I said earlier, the books I was reading in the 80s were all African-American writers. My favorite novels remain things like, Moby Dick and Huck Finn, rather than Virginia Woolf and Joyce. If you'd done an English degree, I think they would be your gods. I feel as if mine are slightly different. So I'm sure it has had an impact, but perhaps in a way I'm not easily able to judge. I mean, the thing I do always have difficulty saying where I'm from, if people ask me, because I've moved around such a lot.
Where were your Yorkshire bits?
Yeah, my Yorkshire bits was... I grew up near Wetherby between 10 and 16, so teenage years. Mm. And I can claim anywhere. Whenever I do a talk in Essex, I say, I lived in Essex, which I did as a child. Durham, I'm claimed sometimes as a Geordie if I go to, do a talk up there. Staffordshire, which is where my parents lived for 20 years. London, I lived for a long time. Mm. I'm like a cat. I think I've had 9 lives.
And You settled?
Yeah, I like the Fens. Yeah. I think I might be settled in the Fens. I do like them. Mm.
And it's now, I think, good timing, really. Over to you. This is the time for maybe the roving microphone and questions. And this is where we sit in silence until someone is brave to
be
break
brave.
The silence.
And, sure, you've got a question.
I got a few more on here if you want to read one out. Oh, we've got one. Good.
How does it feel to be self-branded with the Rich and Judy book club thing for the summer and the self-connotations that go with that?
It was a little bit unfortunate for me in that the year that it happened was the year they went to the digital channel. So Amanda Ross, the producer, did say to me that she had made 8 millionaires out of Richard and Judy authors, and she said, it was your year. Yours was the book. You were going to be... Well, I'm not, because actually the viewing figures were minuscule, and it did die a bit of a death. So in that, it's a... The thing is, I've no difficulty with selling books. I mean, I think any author wants to sell books. The interesting thing is how it's affecting my new novel that I'm beginning. Because in the past, I work under a sort of imposed delusion that no one is going to read me. That's how I write. That helps me. I keep that going. I know it's not true, but that's what I sort of keep telling myself. I can just do this. No one will read this. Then at publication, I usually get very, very anxious, and that's a difficult time for me when that is exposed. And actually, interestingly, now I'm starting a new novel, and The Great Love has sold enormously. I have a feeling, oh my God, lots of people might read this. Mm. And so, for example, a really simple thing is the preface of it is a little poem, a sort of, I think, probably a Victorian poem with the word fuck in it. And I was thinking once, well, I must censor that, because lots of people are going to read this. Mm. With my first novel, I wouldn't have minded at all. Anyway, I haven't censored it. But it's just the business of working against something slightly. I do feel differently. I would say that any author who's had the Richard and Judy experience will say it makes a difference. Mm. You're hugely differently promoted. You're in every bookshop in a way that authors want to be. And I don't know about you, Martin, but I think it's the most heartbreaking experience, and we've all had it, to go into a bookshop and not find your book there. Because if people can't buy it, exactly. The week it's got a great review somewhere major and it's not in a bookshop.
Sent it back.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. And we all have that experience, a very common one. And since The Rich and Judy, I didn't have that experience. I could go to Corby Services and find my book in a bookshop there.
How many times did you go there?
Well, I picked that one because I really did do that. It was so amazing.
Going back,
I bought three. I thought I'd buy them and that would be a good thing in some way. I don't know what came over me. So thank you for that question.
One of the things that struck me about the novel was just how kind of odd the class politics were. You have this kind of serving girl who's overhearing these Cambridge undergraduates and the terrible kind of pretentious language of them. They have sardines on toast, but it's whales on toast. The notion of Rupert Brooke goes off with his friend to kind of to tell the working man about Fabianism and socialism, but, you know, kind of fails. And it struck me that the beginning, the novel seemed to be really much more about sex and quite a lot about Rupert Brooke's penis, and then suddenly about class. And in fact, the two things seem to be kind of tied up, you know, as if that's the nexus of the novel.
He didn't half go on about his penis a lot, so a lot of that, it's a bit like the Pudsey Dawson, it was him, interestingly. And he was a young man. You know, I've said in another piece I've written about him, he was like all young men of that age. He was trying desperately to get people into bed, it seems to me. And he was, yeah, and he was rather driven by sort of his hormones. And so in a way, that was dictating how the novel began. The interesting thing about the politics is that my temptation was to make Nell a suffragette and more political. And I resisted it because I think that's something novelists do, which is a sort of idealizing of the past, or a belief that if I were a woman then, I would be on the side of feminism or forward thinking or, you know, Guardian reading politics. Whereas in fact, it always feels as if the majority of people are not, and the working classes in particular at that time were incredibly conservative, as many would be now, so Daily Mail reading kind of characteristics. So to give her that sort of personality, she resists politics and thinks that Kitty is foolish for becoming a suffragist, I suppose. She does join them briefly. Kitty, that is.
And gets imprisoned.
Yes. And it is very different for girls of her class than for the middle class
women. An interesting bit where she's treated so differently, and the notion of equality just does not exist.
Yeah. It's I read that. I remember a conversation with Ali Smith where she was saying, oh, no, there was lots of working class girls who were, you know, marching with them. And I thought, I'm going to do a bit more research. Let's see what their fate is. And the reality was that once they were in prison, it was a very different matter. And this, you know, Lady Constance Lytton or whoever it might be could still get the Home Journal brought in. And when she got out of prison, she was, you know, greeted by all her comrades as it sort of heroically. Whereas a girl with a reputation for having been in prison who belonged to the working classes, you could only have been a prostitute, a common thief, a shoplifter, you're in trouble. It's a very different matter. So I wanted to get that across. But just in Rupert's defense, I think this business of his Fabianism is quite interesting because the description of him going off and the sort of language he uses about the British working man, that's his phrase, and the lower orders, it's often he's being quite ironic and playful in his letters, and he knows he is self-conscious amongst them. I think that continues. That's a very interesting theme to me, that you know, being educated in a particular way and having a kind of public school education, perhaps, or whatever, does make people feel, I think, uncomfortable mixing up. I don't think that's changed hugely. But I did admire at least the effort. He did seem genuinely to want to find out more. I believed that was real, that he just didn't know how to go about it any better than he did. He couldn't boil an egg, you know. He went away for 2 weeks, and Nell has to sort of provide him with the food he needs. And he was worried about feeding the horse, which he'd never done. I mean, he's just hopeless. But that felt to me acceptable. I quite liked the effort, despite it being laughable, too. And so I just mimicked his language in that and his kind of descriptions of that.
I like the meeting with August John's children as well. That was sort of a shifting out of...
And that's very well described in a letter to Noel Olivier. They're all their names mixing up now. And he was a great exaggerator. I mean, like a lot of people when they tell a story. So he kept saying there was hundreds of children in this scene. And it was quite hard for me to find out how many were there. And actually, I got it wrong. And Augustus John's granddaughter wrote to me.
Oh, really? Not six?
I think it was that there was six, but the oldest would have been David, or whoever I said it was, it wasn't.
Okay.
There's a note about that in the paperback, because I actually felt that was fair enough, that she should mind that I would get that right.
It's a very nice idea, the woman in a cell reading home. You think you should have ideal cell and garden.
Yeah, that's right. I know.
More questions? All good.
I just wondered if you had made any contact with Mike Reed during your research, because I believe he is quite knowledgeable about Rupert Brooke.
Yes.
And if you did you find him really helpful?
I did find him very helpful. Had a long conversation with him very early on. He's the one who really knew that about this Tahitian daughter, and he's the only one who stuck his neck out and said Brooke had a daughter. That's Mike Read's discovery. So I met up with him, and he's a huge Rupert Brooke fan. He has a lock of Rupert's hair. He's quite bonkers about him, I think. But he was immensely helpful, and I sent him a copy of the book. You know, I always like to acknowledge people. He is acknowledged. But the thing he didn't go do, he didn't physically go to Tahiti as I did. So his was based on, he had a photograph of the daughter where she possibly has a resemblance to Brooke. I'm not sure she does, you know, I think a man on a galloping horse. Yeah, I might think so. I don't know. He's not a biographer after all. It was his only biography, I think, that he's ever written. So he's not, it wasn't scholarly.
No, he's a disc jockey from my era.
Yeah, exactly.
So I thought it was fascinating when I found out that he was an expert in, you know.
And he loves Rupert Brooke's work. And I think he might well be, he might not be the president any longer, but he's involved in the Rupert Brooke Society. And I spent a lot of time with them. And in fact, the orchard is owned by a friend of Mike Reed's, another real Rupert Brooke fan called Robin Callan. And Mr. Callan, I can say this because I'm not in Cambridge, used to open the door to me in his dressing gown. It was quite a strange older man. but then he would say things like, would you like to see Rupert's diary? Oh, I'm being recorded, aren't I?
Yes.
No, for God's sake. And the diary is Rupert Brooke's diary, which really you'd think ought to be in a museum or something. And normally, I mean, when we see a sort of rare document, you probably might have gloves on. You certainly have to use a pencil, don't you? You don't expect to be just given the diary. So I went up to Rupert's old bedroom with the diary. I was thinking to myself, oh, I could tear this up, eat it, you know, steal it. It was just a really nerve-wracking feeling. And he had bought that at auction for $20,000 or something. So between him and Mike Read, there's a lot of collecting of Rupert Brooke memorabilia. And once they decided that I was on side and they would let me in, it was fabulous, actually. And Mary Archer showed me around the old vicarage. She was very open as well. I mean, she has a vested interest in a way, and I suppose, a particular version of Rupert Brooke, but she was, you know, very generous about it. When I say a particular version, I think it is the sort of the more gilded youth kind of version, upholding certain English values. But she was immensely open.
And I think that's probably why you want to be factual, because when you've met people like that, that, you know, it matters then, doesn't it, to those people? Yeah, thanks.
Is that another question?
Yes.
Yeah, that lady had her hand up.
Surprise you in your research on Brooke? I mean, you must have set out with a sort of image of what you were expecting to find. Did anything change in the course of the research?
Lots of things. I mean, the sort of, say, the very frank description of his sexual encounter with Denham Russell Smith, I think was very surprising because of the freshness of the language in some ways. Wow, people wrote that openly about sex, using those kind of words. And when I was writing Fred and Edie and had tried to find out how people expressed themselves about sex in the 1920s, what slang did they use, what words did they use, it had proven very difficult to find a woman from Ilford in writing. When you're doing someone who's so well documented, his letters are going to be kept, that kind of thing. I mean, Edie's letters were kept, and actually that was, in the end, what I used, of course, to get her sense of it. But I couldn't get a general sense. So one of the things that surprised me was his language, the slang he used. Sometimes when he said, I remember him saying in one of his letters, oh, the maid came this morning, I forgot to tip her, she was really natty. But I wouldn't have thought natty was a word from 1910. That felt, you know, I don't know, American or 1950s or something. So it was constantly that feeling, oh, the language isn't what I'm expecting. I also think that I had thought he was more, I didn't think he was as funny as he was. He really had a brilliant sense of humor and often did make me laugh, and very coarse, which amuses me and is quite childish and pleases me immensely. So I felt great, I can get along with this aspect of him. He likes to shock. He likes to, you know, say the rudest thing he can think of and put it in a letter. And that's not quite what one might expect from Rupert Brooke, but was, I felt, endearing in the end.
I read in his letters that he went to see the play of Peter Pan about 10 times.
Yes.
So I don't know whether that, does that fit in with the cheeky side of the
Yes,
character?
He went to see it, I think, much more than 10 times, about 54 or something. He really was obsessed with Peter Pan. And I think that's an interesting figure for him to be obsessed with, you know, sort of endlessly young. the sort of, well, the kind of Cliff Richard syndrome as well, and not growing up, which I think is, he is often, especially his work, is seen as having that quality. And then when someone dies young, we never know. We know more about the death than about the work in the end. So that's often the only fact people really remember about him, is he died in the First World War. And they don't necessarily remember that he wrote travel pieces, for example, and a play, a very bad play. And also that his poetry in Tahiti in the South Seas, I thought, was much my favorite. And he might have gone on to be a novelist, because he was certainly saying he considered it. He might write a novel about Tatamata, he says, which is his Tahitian girlfriend. So that was a surprise. I think he was a very good prose writer.
I'm just a little curious about, when you write poetry, do you write poetry in the traditional forms of villanelle, sestina, or sonnet, etc.? What's your opinion about those classic poetry? Do you draw inspirations from the classic works when you write? Thank you.
Well, that's an interesting one. I haven't written poetry for a long time, since I was 28 or whatever. Whenever I run that Eric Gregory, that was it. I never wrote another poem. But when I read, what I actually love is, I suppose, a writer like Jamie McKendrick, if you know his work, where they are working with classic forms quite often, like a sonnet, a very strict, but it's a contemporary sort of investigation of that form, so it's not a pastiche. That's probably what I do like. I used to like much freer poetry, and I think in time I've grown to admire a bit more of a sort of, and in fact it's possibly why I don't do it, because I think if you don't have a really brilliant grasp of meter and form, I don't like prose poems very much, which was the kind of thing I was doing. I feel that what happened is my poetry went into my fiction, and I found a happier home for it, if that makes sense.
And any likelihood of ever stretching towards biography? Have you read a biography that reads to you like a novel?
Yes, I love biography. I mean, I do read biographies. But no, I soon learned I wasn't ever going to be a biographer during this, in that I absolutely have a difficulty with the idea of ever writing a statement in the third person. You will notice my work is very often in the first person. So if someone is speaking it, whether it's Nell, whether it's Rupert, I'm just suggesting it's entirely subjective. And that's, I think, what I believe about language, about everything. For me, so when I try to write, even as journalism troubles me, I do some journalism, but for the same reason, the third person form is difficult. Mm-hmm. So the only biography I could imagine would be in the first person, then that would be, I think, difficult and would become a novel. Right. I like those experimental ones. I do like Peter Ackroyd, and I have liked Hermione Lee, her Virginia Woolf. I love reading about people. I suppose that is the thing that intrigues me most. But it seems to me it's a very particular, a bit like the poetry question. I'll leave it to others who I think do it better, like yourself.
So you're on the road at the moment. You've been on the road quite a bit. And what's it like for you when you suddenly find time away from writing? Because I know when you're doing the research, you're writing the book contemporaneously, obviously because writing is an urge or a need. But what's it like to suddenly have to be on the promotional run?
Well, I think as I indicated a bit in the Richard and Judy question, I find it a little difficult. I mean, I definitely have sort of, if I'm ever going to have an illness, that's when it will be. It's a sort of stressful thing. I think because it's the opposite, isn't it? When you think about writing, it's a very private activity alone. It's just me in a room with my computer and some illusion that it's only ever going to stay there. And then meeting people, meeting readers, meeting people who've read the book is sort of disconcerting and unnerving, I think, actually, much as it's also nice. So I think the two... So once I start promoting, this book's had such a lot of promotion that, in fact, I haven't been writing at all, but that's fine. I often do need a long gap between books. And I think that's why my books, people always say, well, they're very different, or you're doing a whole different period in time, or... I mean, it's certainly true of the last... Well, in fact, I think it is true of all of them, really, that I like to sort of set them in a different period and write about a completely different topic. And it seems to me that's because I have a long time off in between, so I'm not actually writing the same novel. I'm not continuing the investigation in another form. not that there's anything wrong with that, but it feels to me I've done with it.
Does it take a while as well to let that period go?
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's sort of an energy, isn't it, that just has to be left behind, especially when you're really immersed. So something like a novel that requires so much research, it seems to me there is an immersion, and I did start to feel I was going a bit mad with the old Rupert Brooke, and there was a point where I opened the glove compartment in the car and a postcard of Rupert Brooke fell out, and my husband said, enough! It's like, you know, I'm going to go on forevermore with sort of Rupert Brooke. You have to kind of drop it eventually, it seems to me.
Jealous.
I think he probably did feel like it was too much of an obsession.
Yeah. Any other question? Is there one that was like a little countdown now? There's another question remaining? Anything? I'm just delighted to thank you all very much for coming, and thank Jill very much for a truly sort of warm, engaging, articulate, insightful talk about her book and general sort of art and skill and wonder of being the writer you are. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.